Do we have any questions or comments from last week's class or this week's reading that you would like to bring up before I start? Okay, you seldom do, but I'd like to give you the chance. This week when I was reading through these chapters, this book is all mixed up in my mind with all of the experiences that we had with the SRF lawsuits and so on. It's just very hard to separate it all out. It came right out of that experience, and there was so much conversation about the subjects covered in this book over the 12 years that we were in that dispute that it's sort of, that's the only way I can approach this. It's not just what's in the book, of course. The biggest question that people would ask over and over again over the years that we've had disputes with SRF is, how could people who are direct disciples of a great master become so confused, at least from our point of view, confused? Of course, from their point of view, they would ask the same question. And it's not a small question, because it's the question that all of us as devotees, none of us can feel absolutely safe from being swept up in delusion until we're in Nirvikalpa Samadhi and have reason to believe that we're free from delusion forever, which probably is going to be a while. So even though we can sort of say, oh, this would never happen to me, I'd never get caught by that, humility is the better part of wisdom in a case like this. And if you're forewarned and can understand some of the cycles that people go through, you're safer still. And it also behooves us as devotees to really have the courage to look straight at these difficult issues, rather than for many years, I recall through the whole cycle of conflict with SRF, and then when the Bertolucci lawsuit happened also, we made a tremendous effort, for those of you who lived through all of that, to be big communicators, you know, passing on as much information, as many facts, as many insights as we could possibly share without violating court protective orders, because it was an important process that people be allowed to have all the information so they could think for themselves. And I know about 6 or 7 or 8 years into it, when the energy was reaching its most fevered pitch, a very fine friend sort of suddenly started asking questions that should have been answered a long time ago. And I said to her, you know, we've been talking about this for years. Where have you been? She said, well, I chose to put my head in the sand. I chose not to know. I thought it was more spiritual not to know. I said, well, that was unfortunate, wasn't it? Because now you're out of the loop, and you're trying to sort of understand what's happening, but you haven't had all these years to work up to it like the rest of us have had. And It was a difficult process. Now, I use that as just an isolated example, but what I'm really trying to say is, if something happens, it happens for a good reason, and we have to have the courage to look at it. And we can't just say, oh, it's too much for me to understand. I don't want to understand it. It's somebody else's problem. I think one of the reasons Swamiji wrote this book is so that we would look at these things and would really think about them. And in this chapter, the fourth chapter called The Third Presidency, he really, sentence by sentence, describes the whole relationship with Dayamata and how complex it was and how subtle was the misunderstanding. And without exonerating her in any way, he's yet also very fair to her and fair to himself in sort of showing how people's realities can go. And there's just so many things in here that are so important in terms of that particular experience, in terms of what happens to institutions, and very simply in terms of what happens to people. The most touching aspect of this, which he says many different times, is we didn't know how different our point of view really was. I've had a number of experiences in my life because of the fact that I both do public speaking and do private counseling, have done private counseling over the years, that I'm amazed sometimes what people think I said or what people think I meant. And sometimes even the extent to which deep and serious trauma is created by an interpretation rather than an actual perception. And yet I don't really know what can be done about that. One can become fanatically exact in one's language, but people will see reality, and I include myself in this, because I myself have also been on the receiving. I have acted it out as many times as it has been acted out against me. I'm not holding myself blameless in this. Where one starts with an emotional predisposition, sincere or nefarious, whatever it might be, but just some kind of an orientation that makes reality a certain way. And then you go on for a long time, and only much later does it ever get sorted out that that was never actually what was happening. And God uses those things sometimes. Sometimes you have to be very kind to yourself when it finally straightens out, because you realize if I hadn't had those thoughts, then all of these things wouldn't have happened that needed to happen. And even the way Swami talks about, he lists out in this chapter this long cycle of all these different things that Master said to him that were so fundamental to Swamiji's understanding of what his guru wanted of him and what Master even wanted for his work. And only much later did he realize nobody ever heard Master say any of it. Everything happened, except, as he said, except one incident where there was one monk who never figured very prominently and left the work anyway. Nobody ever witnessed it. Now, there's so many dimensions of this which is fascinating. Earlier in one of these chapters, Swamiji essentially apologizes to Dayamata in the most subtle way, within the part that we already read, when he says, I was wrong to try to persuade her to be someone other than she is, in essence. How could I ever have expected her to be anyone other than she is? Now, Swamiji doesn't, he doesn't issues that apology, but he doesn't show you the pages and pages and pages and pages of letters that he's written to her over the years. It's in the early years trying to persuade her to see it from a different point of view. He made a massive effort, because it took him all these years. He even writes in this chapter too, you know, one of the paradoxes, one of the remarkable things, I won't call it a paradox, one of the extraordinary facts about Swamiji's life is that all that he describes here about what actually happened between himself and Dayamata, I mean, he's always known it, it always had happened. Yet in 1976, when he was writing his own autobiography, The Path, and it came to the time where he had to write about Dayamata, he wrote about her in such glowing terms, really. I don't think there was a word of criticism in that book except about her directly. In fact, he made her seem such an exemplary devotee that he actually formed the culture at Ananda of respect for her. It was primarily his words in that book that formed a culture of respect for her at Ananda, because the majority of us had no contact with her. A few people had come through SRF and had, for some reason, formed some independent admiration or sense of spirituality. But the majority of us, she was non-existent. And yet, by the words he spoke and by what he wrote in that book, many of us, including myself, just on a sort of deep subconscious level, without ever really asking, why do I think this, we thought highly of her. And I watched myself as like a magnificent canary in the cage on the issue, because I had no reason at all to like her and many reasons to dislike her. And yet I too thought for a long time she must be a great soul. And finally I sat back and I thought, why do I think that? And I realized, because Swamiji said so. Now, considering, as you read through this book, the degree to which she, well, betray is a word, he's kinder to her than that, but he hints at it. You know, her desire to appease both sides amounted to that, is how he puts it in a very gracious way, because he's trying to see it from her point of view. But nonetheless, he had so much fairness, is I think the word that I want to use, and that's how he puts it in here. People have asked me recently, don't you want to change what you wrote in The Path? We were reprinting The Path in the middle of the whole SRF lawsuit, and don't you want to change what you've written there, sir? And he said, no, for all the reasons he explains here. That also was true, and it was true at the time. He said, why spoil one reality because of a subsequent reality? And he still holds to the last that she's one of his closest friends, and then he still gives her the benefit of believing that she feels that same way about him. Because he describes this dynamic spiritual partnership. She is about, I think, 12 years older than him. She was maybe even that much older than him in the work. He was the enthusiastic young man who was capable of doing so much. He talks about how at the beginning she so enjoyed the fact that he was so creative in the way he did things. That there she is trying to run this organization, barely able to deal with it, and she's a real go-getter here in Swamiji, who's always up, who's always positive, who's got pulled all the monks together, who's this wonderful teacher, who's this fabulous musician who can make these records for them, who can travel to foreign countries and speak their languages, who makes the monastery, as one of the older monks said when Swami, this is what he says now, he said, it was Swami Turiyananda, I think, who said it, but I might be wrong. He said, the golden age of SRF was when Kriyananda was here. He said, then laughter rang in the halls, is how he put it. Now, you can imagine Swamiji's joyous nature, even as it is now, but imagine that in a man in his 20s. You know, I mean, the energy must have just been phenomenal. And for him, you know, everything is always a lark. He's always in a happy mood, and he laughs so much about so easily. So for her, it was just an enormous benefit to have him there. But then he describes how these sort of subtle balances of all these different influences. And last week we talked about how there was that strong karmic inclination to institutionalize the work of this avatar, for Kali Yuga to grab it and kill it the same way as Christianity was killed. And you see how all those forces are at work here. I was exchanging a letter with, I was having a discussion with someone at the village recently. I might as well mention this specific issue. A number of years ago, and I'm sure some of you were present on that occasion, it was a spiritual renewal week at Ananda Village. And at the end of it, someone stood up, and in the way that people are, they're gracious. She started to thank various people for the things they had done. She thanked this one and she thanked that one, and then there was applause for the cooks and applause for the teachers. And when she was about halfway through, I think I spoke about this at Christmas now that I remember, last Christmas, Swamiji just said, you know, I really don't favor doing this sort of thing, standing up and thanking everyone. He said, because where will it stop? He said the teachers would not have been able to speak in such an inspiring manner if all of you hadn't been so receptive. So all of you should be praised for being receptive. And he went on. And then he just said, we do it for God. Well, every so often, you get a newsletter from one colony to another, and many pages of it are devoted to lists of people who did things and the people who are thanking them. And besides the fact that, with all due respect, it's boring reading for the most part, I always think about what Swamiji said and don't want to lose that, and also want to inquire if others heard it the same way I did. Because even things that are spoken publicly, I've learned over the years, sometimes only one or two people seem to hear it. Or if they hear it, they hear it differently. You know, it may strike me as being enormously important. For years, when we were trying to work out the various governance of the colonies versus... When Ananda went from being one community to being a worldwide organization in a matter of a few years, and it was a little confusing as to who was in charge of who and what, we were just sort of working out different issues. And, of course, all I ever heard, all I could ever remember was the thing Swami said about decentralization and autonomy, and because I was very much on that side of the equation. And then other people would tell me all these other things he said when I had been present, and I could hardly ever remember them, or I wasn't present when they were spoken. Because they just weren't the message that I was going to respond to. It's just the way it is. Swami's just been... The reason he can write so fairly about Dhyamata is that he's so good at that himself. He's found a balance point, which is slightly different, which is he can make every person feel supported, but he will take a stand. You know, he will hold to a certain point of view. He won't waffle from side to side. But nonetheless, you'll feel sympathetically heard, which is what you want a lot of the time anyway. Or I can give examples, but I won't right at the moment. I don't want to go too far afield. But in any case, let's see now what I was saying was, I was having a discussion about that business about thanking people, which, you know, everybody has a pet peeve. I think it's because I do a lot of writing, and so I hate to see newsletters get boring. And so that's why I respond. When I see newsletters get boring, that's like one of my little touch points, so I get in there on that one. But I was saying, you know, we have to be so vigilant on these things because human nature being what it is, there is a tremendous tendency just to pull things back to whatever our comfort zone was or the way our parents raised us or some sort of unquestioned assumption about wouldn't that be a good idea? Like, of course we would think it would be a good idea to make lists and lists of thanking people for what they've done. I mean, why not? Everybody does it. But you have to stand back for a moment. You have to re-examine every issue from the point of view of self-realization as to whether or not that's really true. And we watch it in our own lives. We watch it in our institution. And this is the story that Swami tells us that happened to SRF. When people would ask me through the years, how did it ever get to this point? I said, well, it didn't happen all at once. It happened a quarter of an inch at a time. And you stand in one place, and then a quarter of an inch at a time, you move. And now, see, this is about institutions. But this is a macrocosm of the microcosm that happens to us. We make one little self-justification, one little rationalization, one little opportunity not to listen carefully but to blame someone else, one little decision to take a lower energy alternative instead of a higher energy alternative, one little thought that I'm going to run away from something instead of facing it. And all of them seem so small in themselves, but cumulatively they make a whole direction. And so Swami talks about how he and Diamanta had this working relationship. But their whole idea of what Master's work was so different. And it's almost like I have read this so many times and I've heard this talked about so many times. And still, there are certain sentences I have to just concentrate really deeply to even understand what he's saying that Diamanta actually believed. Because as Swamiji says, you know, to him, and therefore to Ananda, and therefore to most of us, what exists is individuals and their need for spiritual support and spiritual sustenance. But Swami would use examples, like he said when he was in India, a man spoke to him about, you know, where should he needed spiritual, I mean, I can't think exactly how the question was, but the man asked essentially for spiritual advice. And Swamiji said to him, well, is there a Sri Aurobindo ashram near where you live? And the man said, yes. Swami said, well, I think perhaps you should go there. And it was just an intuitive response on Swamiji's part, and it turned out the man confessed that, well, he was very drawn to Aurobindo and had been thinking of going there and so on. And Swami said later, he said, if the board of directors in Los Angeles had heard me do that, you know, that my job was not to send people to Sri Aurobindo. My job was to draw them to SRF. And that was what I was here for, was to bring people into this organization. And I try to think about how we counsel and how we help people. And it's always so open-ended. You know, if this will help you, then do come. And, well, I don't really feel, I don't like to join. I don't like to be members. I only like the kirtans. Well, then just come to the kirtans. And just whatever will help you is all that we're trying to do. We're not just sort of looking through the world for those who are going to become members and make our organization stronger and do and live according to this plan that we have. And we have to even think for a moment what that would feel like. And the other part of it that Swami is constantly reminding us of is that Diamanta never worked with the public. Now, all of us, and almost all of you, with perhaps just a few exceptions, have always lived or been part of Ananda in an environment essentially like this. Some of you have lived in a more isolated place, but I've spent half my Ananda life in Palo Alto and half of it at Ananda Village. And now the majority is shifting over to this reality. I've lived in here for so long, and what I call this to myself is I call this a missionary station. And I sort of, finally, after years of bearing in mind that all of this whole reality of Ananda Village and branch colonies and so on has all just developed in the last, well, 15, 16 years, as long as we've been here, basically, and as Ananta has been in Sacramento. And it's just taken us a while to think about it. And in a missionary station, with all due respect, and it's pretty much just family here tonight, you're surrounded by the heathen. And of course, the heathen don't look like the way heathen look when we think of them as being barefoot and cannibals or something like that. But we're surrounded by people whose inclination is not necessarily toward self-realization. And they're heathen in the sense that they're not devotees. Not yet, at least. And so our whole like measurement for reality is people who are very disinterested and have none of this inspirational way of life as part of their makeup. And we're just anxious for them to even look this direction, to come in the door, to take any of it. And success has to be measured by anything that moves them closer to the light. And we use East-West as an enormous vehicle, just not necessarily to bring people to Ananda, although we're happy to do that if it's appropriate, but just to move them toward the light. And that's the way you think when you're in a missionary field, right? And there's a whole other way of life that now I'm so far away from I can hardly even remember, but I lived it for years, which is when you just leave it all behind and go live in an ashram or go live in a monastery somewhere. And even Ananda Village was so much more open than a Kali Yuga kind of monastery, much more open than the SRF monastery certainly has become. But the whole mindset was, I've incarnated to realize God. And I just don't want to have anything to do with that world out there. I mean, there were years of my life I still hear people talk about. And there was like, you know, 10 years where I was totally disconnected from the media. No radio, no television, no newspapers, nothing. And I mean, I didn't mind at all, and I'm hardly plugged in now, but I was totally disconnected. People will talk about many things that happened, not as bad as Swami. The teenage kids got such a kick out of the fact that Swami didn't know who Michael Jackson was. That's really impressive. They made it a mission to inform him, you know. Swami's response, actually, they brought him some records and he listened. He said, I don't like what he does, but he does it perfectly. He said he's exactly, Swami's comment was, he's exactly in tune with the times. He knows just how to express it. He does it perfectly. He said, I don't like what he does, but he does it as well as it can be done. It's interesting because he says what he wants to say. In any case, but that way of thinking is, what difference does it make anyway? What's going on in this world? I'm not interested in worldly people. It's not that I'm not willing to help people, but I'm not going at it. I'm not in a missionary station. I'm just doing what God asked me to do with the right consciousness, and the less I am involved in anything, the better. It's a true monastic renunciate consciousness. I'm sure all of you can relate to it to a greater or lesser extent. Some of you have also devoted yourself for long periods of time to that same way of thinking. It's different. It's just different. And now, as I say, I can hardly even think about it. Like, sometimes people say, well, would you go back to Ananda Village? I said, what would I do? But then I stop and I think, well, I could find lots to do because I would just let go of all of this, let's, you know, reach more people, let's build the work, let's do this, let's find new creative ways of doing all these things. I would just go back into a much simpler and in many ways much more relaxing, more natural, really, in many ways more natural. Even now, David and I went to Greece or somewhere, I think it was on Greece, we went up to this island and we went to this old, you know, now barely or deserted monastery, and there was this little stone room with this little stone bed and this little cold water tap, and I just walked in there and I thought, home. Oh, I just loved it. Because it just brought forth all of that, who cares? There's this, that story that, is it in The Path, or I'm not sure where it is, but about the two sadhus who were buried under the ground and somebody was excavating for a building and found them meditating there. And disturb their meditations. And one said, what yuga is this? What yuga is this? And he said, they said, Kali Yuga. He said, oh, I'm not interested. I mean, it's too materialistic an age. Why would I want to be conscious now? And so he just left his body. But you see, that's a mindset that you can get into. Now, it's a legitimate mindset. That's the important point you have to realize. It's a legitimate mindset, but it can lead to aberrations. And it wasn't, and this is where Dayamata and Swami disagree. Daya now states publicly that Master came to found a monastery. Swami says it doesn't make any sense that he came to found a monastery. He came to revolutionize the whole age. You can't revolutionize the age from a monastery. He came to make a beachhead in SRF as a missionary station, set up to create inspiration. And to Swamiji, it was so self-evident, it took him a long time before he realized that it wasn't. Now, it's very hard for me to articulate, and I certainly can't articulate any better than Swamiji has, what it was exactly that Daya and Tara thought they were doing. But I think it's summed up by Tara's comment saying, I just thought Master was going to gather his disciples and take us all back to India. You know, and when he started Mount Washington, she said, well, now your troubles really begin. You know, it wasn't like, oh, isn't this thrilling, sir? We're going to found this headquarters. We're going to set up this international work. We're going to reach so many people. There are hungry people all over the world. She said, oh, boy, now your headaches start. Because, well, she would make his books, but only so many of them. When Swamiji asked, where are the rest of them? She said, well, people have enough books. It's just almost unreal, isn't it? But he also, Tara is the most fascinating character, of course, in the whole story. And Swami does such a magnificent job of drawing her personality and making her even sympathetic. And he did make the simple comment that she suffered for her errors too. At the end of her life in 1970, I think, just when Ananda started, she had a terrible stroke. And the last 2 years of her life, she was paralyzed and could hardly speak. And she said, this happened to me to teach me compassion. Because she was a great soul. And Swamiji has always said, whatever mistakes she made, as soon as she realizes them, she will repudiate them. Because she had that kind of spirit. And Swami's so fair. I love what he says. I prefer, you know, strength to mediocrity. And that whole story he gives in there about how some people seem like they're pretty nice, but they just really don't have enough energy to really have their faults show. And that little comment about, you know, people, the neighbors say about the murderer, oh, he seemed like such a nice man. What do we really know of people? And part of that, see, a lot of this, and over the years, whenever there's been a question, and Swamiji has said, should I really publish that? Should I really write that? I've always been on the side of we should put it all up on the internet. I've just felt like we should respect people enough to give them all the information that exists. Everyone has the right to have it because they should be able to make up their own minds. And, of course, that is eventually sort of pretty much where everything has gone. But let's see. Oh, part of this is, you see what, there's this tendency. Nowadays, it's very, very difficult, for example, to really even, unless you have a lot of intuition, to understand what Jesus was really like. You have to really read between the lines and really try to feel and have a lot of intuition and pick up the pieces and so on, because there's such a tendency to make these figures, you know, to worship them more and more. And it's so dangerous spiritually. It's so bad spiritually. My passion, you know, to fight against SRF has been because I am so involved with people in this part of my life that I see the damage that's done, because we just think, oh, these are, as SRF tries to say, no, I just love it every time they say it, Master's beloved Tara Mata. You know, she just, and Swami writes about her, I mean, she's much more interesting even than Master's beloved Tara Mata. But you see also, if you just have this sort of pantheon of all these great and wonderful disciples, all of whom are cut out of cardboard and pasted up there, and all of their foibles and human qualities are just erased, where does that leave us? You see, it just leaves us nowhere. We have no place to go. That's on the deepest level, that's what's happened to Christianity and Judaism both. I recall this rabbi came to me once. This is one of the stranger encounters I've had, I think. He came to me because he had to talk to someone, and I think he needed to find somebody just sort of outside his world who he thought could understand. He said, I went into the Sunday school, and I was supposed to explain Judaism to the children, he said, and I didn't know what to say. And he was not well-educated, but he sort of, when he had to bring it down to children, he just realized that he couldn't grasp it. And actually, I understand, of course, being raised Jewish and having been back into the temples a number of times since I've been a self-realizationist. And I explained to him how Christianity and Judaism both really ended up in the soup together. Christianity did this strange thing, which is that they made Jesus the only begotten Son of God, completely other than any human being. He didn't have any previous incarnations. He didn't have any subsequent incarnations. He was just like, there was the world, and plop, he appeared perfect. You know, whatever happened to him between the age of 12 and 30, nobody quite knows, but, you know, just he's perfect. And then he dies perfect, and that's the story. And so we just hope that he'll save us. But on an everyday sort of, how do I transform myself? We lost all the sadhana. We lost sadhana. We lost meditation techniques. We lost everything. We lost the possibility of becoming perfect, even as our Father in heaven is perfect. And the Jews, because they repudiated Christ, or because the concept of the Messiah has gotten also confused in their teaching, and they've gone even further. It's that just, you know, there's no saints. There's just, you know, there are these wise rabbis. Human nature being what it is, the wise rabbis become the guru to their disciples because human nature is what it is. But we're never allowed to sort of think that any human being dares to attain the state of consciousness. So we're in the same boat. We can't do anything with it. That's why self-realization is coming to sort of resurrect everything again. It's not that the Jews are wrong or Jesus is wrong. We just sort of took a big piece of it and cut it out with scissors. And that's what institutional religion does, because it's very hard to control people if each one of them is in charge of their own spiritual evolution. It's very hard to control them if spiritual evolution varies, too. That's the problem that the Catholics have with their priests, because all our priests are ordained equal. They're all, you know, equal instruments of God. They all carry on the sacraments and give the Mass and everything, and it's all just the same. You're getting it all from Jesus. It's all from the Church. But some of them, darn it, just seem to be more ordained than others, you know? You just have these ones every once in a while who, when they hand you that wafer, you really get Jesus. And so naturally, people are not stupid. They'll rush over there. And this church will be empty, and that one will be overcrowded. So consistently, they just pull those priests out, and the priests themselves, their word for it is you get sent to prison. You just get isolated somewhere. They took Padre Pio. Padre Pio, when he had the stigmata appeared on his hands and the wounds of Christ appeared, there was a time, it was in the 20s, because that happened to him when he was very young. I saw a film about his life. It was so interesting. There was a time when he was the most photographed human being on the planet. Films, pictures. I mean, it was a phenomenon. But it was just, the Catholic Church just could not handle it. They absolutely forbade him to appear in public, and they forbade any pictures to be taken of him, which I think went on to the end of his life, but people started just breaking it. And then for 7 years, he was forbidden to perform the Mass in public. And he actually had to get a lawyer, whatever you do in that system, and he had to, you know, fight against the Church. And then they sent him to this godforsaken corner of Italy where there was absolutely nothing. And now, of course, there's all this stuff because people will find the saints. But it was just very inconvenient. Everything needs to just be washed out. Otherwise, you can't control it. And now that's the fear that Tara and Daya both had, that if people get too much power, what might happen? If you let people speak in church, what might they say? If you let people sing the song their own way, how might they sing it? It might not be in tune. It might not really represent Master. I mean, just think about it for a minute. We have people read a little bit on Sundays, and so everybody reads a little differently. We have people sing. Everybody sings a little differently. We're not by any means a free-for-all. We're much more controlled than some and much less controlled than others. But you see, you let people express themselves, and they will. And aberration set in. I had to go around and correct damage that I myself created. It's really interesting. Many years ago when we would do the healing prayer, Master's words are, manifest thy healing presence. And somewhere along the line, because I can remember doing it back when I was still living in the monastery, I thought, that's nice, but why don't we say, manifest thy energy, light, and joy? It just seemed more fun to me. You know, I'm a word gopi. Three will work better than a couple. So we just started saying it like that. Now, you may be in many parts of Ananda where everybody says, manifest thy energy, light, and joy. People think that's how the prayer goes. I happen to know for a fact that I started it. Okay? So 20 years later than that, I mean, it's a small thing. It seems tiny, doesn't it? 20 years later, 30 years later, I just happened to be reading something about Master and his healing. And there's a whole section about how the presence of God is healing. I mean, it's just a beautiful, subtle thought there that I had just casually erased. Just erased it. And I sent emails out and I notified everyone. I said, you know, something's going on here that I would like to correct. I don't want to die with this karma on my shoulders. But you see, I laugh too, and I did my best to correct it, and it's still. So now some people say manifest thy healing presence, thy energy, light, and joy. Okay, fine, no problem. And people are putting long lists of thank yous into the villagers, into the newsletters and stuff like that. But imagine if you were afraid of those things. Imagine if all of those things, if you had rigidified your spiritual path to such an extent that even the mere possibility of those things would make you nervous. You see how differently you would approach it? How you would see just what Tara says, that people are a threat. They're going to dilute it. If you let too many people get involved who aren't pure and good and straight and clear and total renunciates and absolutely willing to sacrifice and go under obedience to us, what will happen? As opposed to, even when we first came here, many years ago now, the forms of Ananda have certain realities, and we, a number of years ago, created the we call the monastic order for householders, and you can become a life member of that monastic order over a certain period of time if it's appropriate. And that has always been my track in life. And living in the ashram as I did all those years, and just sort of especially the early sort of core group years, that's what it was for me to be on the spiritual path. And I behaved badly for a number of years when I was first here, because I would see everybody, I would see the true way to be on the path is to be a life member of the monastic order, and then therefore only a few measured up. And it was subtle, but that was just always the thought form, which is, well, they're nice, but... And then one day I said, well, why don't we just flip this and say the reality of life is that nobody cares at all. So if anybody's willing to say, Om, let's praise them, let's just sort of, let's flip it around. The definition is not this absolute dedication. The definition is anybody who's willing to be interested. And then of those, a few will go farther if it's their destiny to go farther, but everything helps. That's what you see in Swamiji. I watched him once. He gave a talk at a Church of Religious Science in Reno, Nevada. He used to go to some strange venues. I shouldn't say that, because actually there's a lot of very spiritual people in Reno. But that particular church, I withdraw all comments about it. I think the strangeness of it was my inexperience. Now my mind runs through the whole thing. It wasn't strange at all. It was just that I was just a little kid living in an ashram. I always think of myself as a kid. When Swamiji and Kalyani and I were in Hawaii in the summer of maybe 75 or something, he was there editing the path. And she came over to help, and then he asked me to come over. And we were there about 3 weeks, and he was editing part one of the path. And we were staying in somebody's condominium, and we just needed a day off, and so we just looked through the tourist thing, and there was some kind of a boat trip you could take through the Fern Grotto or something like that. And so I was calling up and making, and she said, how many adults, how many children? And I was just about to say, one adult, two children. And I realized when we showed up, they would probably expect us to pay full price. But it was just like, compared to Swami, you think I'm going to call myself an adult? Of course, I'm just a kid. So I was just a kid. We went to Reno. Swami gave this talk, a wonderful talk. And afterwards, people were wanting to come up and speak to him personally, and he was there to do that. And I don't know what it was about the setting, but that there was some bhav that really set in him, some spiritual mood. And I recall him standing, which he often does. He was standing, not sitting. He was just perfectly still. And his stillness was so much bigger than just the fact that his body wasn't moving. I think his heart was still and his mind was still. And his sense of demand upon these people was nothing. He was demanding nothing. He was simply radiating the inspiration, and it was their free will to take it. And as these people came and stood in front of him, and I was watching off from the side, I could almost see, I'm not a person who has visions, but I have strong intuitions about things. So without actually being able to see it, what I saw was, oh, how many lifetimes these very same souls have stood in front of him. And each time he offers to them as much as their cup will hold. And then they take whatever has been given to them by him, and then they live with it for as long as it takes until they've expanded it or used it or however they've done with it or squandered it. And then it will happen that they'll be standing in front of him again. Among other things, it made me realize how much patience you have to work with people, how people simply cannot, they cannot be forced to bloom. You know, we have flowers, and you just can't force a flower to bloom. It will simply bloom in its own time. With loving care, it can bloom. In right conditions, it can bloom faster, but it just will not bloom until all the elements are in place, and that's what human nature is like. Now, our almost entire definition of the spiritual path, because we've been trained by Swamiji, is to reach out and try to help people bloom. But you could simply not be interested. And that's what Swami's trying to say. Dai had never worked with people. She ran the office. And they helped them with correspondence course and letters and so on. But, you know, it wasn't the kind of visceral awareness that you get when you're there with them every day. And Tara, as Swami says, was a hermit. She just didn't even live at Mount Washington. Master said, keep her away from people. You know, she just was such a, she was just such a character. When Swami says, you know, she used to be beautiful, but she let her body go. She got heavy. She smoked like a chimney, Swamiji said. She was just a very, very unusual person, and almost no one ever saw her. She would just talk to her on the telephone. Almost all of Swami's encounters with her were on the telephone. He talks of it in the conversations with Master that there was only one time when he, Master, and Tara were alone together, once in all the years. Isn't that interesting? It's just so. But once you start with all those things as the premise, that Master came to sort of, you know, that what you need is you need this very strong SRF in which the teachings are extremely clear, when nothing has corrupted them, where it's exactly as Master wanted it to be, where everything is done just the way he wanted it, where all the words are just the way he wanted them, and it's there, and people who have the right spirit and who understand and who are karmically ready, well, they can come and receive it. And you've got to make sure that that fort, or wellspring, if you want to call it that, is really clean and true and strong, and you can't risk having anything cause that to become undermined. You can see the mindset of that? Because if it became undermined, then you would lose everything. Because, as Swami writes also in here, you know, the connection between that headquarters and the role it played and the totality of Master's work. I mean, we joke about it. To us, it's a joke. A bitter joke during the lawsuit, as it gradually became clear to us that there was a complete unity in the minds of these elderly sisters between God, Yogananda, and SRF. It was simply one reality. They just simply couldn't see that there was any other reality. And then, as institutions are, it had extended to include Dayamata, because Dayamata had become the president of SRF, so therefore she was representing SRF, therefore she was representing God and Guru, and therefore she was the same as God and Guru. And it would just be like, and they would just say that to us, like, as if the mere stating of it was persuasive. And we would just like, you know, wait for something sensible to have been said. And we would just all kind of look at each other, just complete non-connect. We had one meeting. Oh, dear. We had one meeting. It was sort of like during the slight period of time we thought we were going to reconcile. And we had a meeting without the direct disciples present. It was just us. And one or the other of the SRF people said something to us like, they essentially stated what Dayamata wanted us to do. And we said, well, we're not going to do that. I mean, like, get real. And they just looked at us like, and all they could think of to do was to repeat what Dayamata wanted us to do. Because the only way they could imagine that we were rejecting it is because we hadn't heard it. And, of course, we'd heard it perfectly clearly. We just disagreed. Somebody told the little story about how, this was Haridasa's, one of great Haridasa-isms. He was one of the first ministers to ever have to start a center, and he and this man named Vijay went to Sacramento. This was in the beginning of time. I don't know when that was, the late 70s? 79 or 80. And he and Vijay rented this suburban house and converted the garage into a temple. They put a a tablecloth, a bedspread over the washer and dryer for services, because the rest of the time they had to use it. And you know, Master called them churches of all religions, so they called it the garage of all religions. That's what we sort of, we always joke about the garage of all religions. Well, he and Vijay were both very independent, free-thinking characters, and they often had very, very different ideas about how things ought to go. And they would often meditate and pray and come up with very different ideas about how things ought to go. And that's when Haridas realized that sometimes God, there can be two God's will. So I can recall in that meeting, I may even have been the idiot who tried to do it, but one of us told Esther of that story, thinking that maybe like that would like get the picture. It didn't. It didn't work. People just looked at us like, you've got to be crazy. How could there be two God's will? But you see from a certain point of view. It's all self-consistent. It all just depends on what you think Master wanted, right from the start. Fascinating, isn't it? And it also just awakens you. And in one hand, as Swami says, Daya wasn't really wrong. She was going according to her own way. That was the wonderful story that Jyotish and David told. I'll tell this and then we'll take a break. They were dealing with someone who was very difficult, and Swamiji had put this, I think it was a man, in a position of responsibility, and the position of responsibility was way beyond his ability to handle it, but it was one of those opportunities that community provides for everybody to work with everybody and learn something as we go along. People deserve the chance, and so they get to have the chance, and they're having the chance. I mean, I finally, over the years, and I don't mean to prevent you from doing this in the future, but over the years, many times people have come to me to tell me how and in what way I have completely failed at the job I'm doing. Generally speaking, they're accurate. Sometimes they're not, but usually they are. And I finally found a perfect answer. And it's the truest answer. I finally found a perfect answer. I don't mean to get them to not do it, because it is the answer. Do you think if I knew how to do this job, I would still be doing it? Of course I'm not doing it right. That's why I'm here. When I finally learn how to do it, I won't have to do it anymore. I mean, that's how you have to look at everything. So Swamiji often gives people jobs they can't do, but of course they supervise people and, you know, things happen and so on. Memorable, very memorable things happen. And it's a good test of attitude for the people who have to live through it. We just hold each other's hands. We take turns. See, that's the thing about it. You take turns. Today it's my turn to have power over you and make your life miserable, and next week you get to have power over me. And I'll hate it just as much, and I'll learn that lesson, and you'll learn this lesson, and at the end we'll all be liberated, and it'll be just worth it. But that's the way it goes. And so Jyotish and Devi were talking to somebody about somebody who was just making a hash of their responsibilities, and they were hoping for some help and how to work with them. Somebody said, well, I think he's doing very well, given who he is. And then about 6 months later, Jyotish and Devi had come under a lot of criticism. They were, you know, they were on the bullseye. Everybody was shooting darts at them. And so they were talking to Swamiji, and they said, sir, I mean, are we doing this job the way you want it done? He said, well, I think you're doing very well, considering who you are. And really, that's it. If you were Jesus Christ himself, you would be able to do it better, you know, but if you were Jesus Christ, you wouldn't have to have that job. So it's not really a real point. Okay, let's take a break. I've lost my train of thought completely, so let's just take a break. Because you're a female, right? Self-evident. Okay. Are we ready, Dharma? Okay. Do we have any comments, thoughts? Anything about what I was saying? Okay, I didn't use the break to get ready for the next half, so I have to stop for a minute. Let's see. Just pull to mind something here. Oh, I know what I had wanted to say. I knew that when I was wandering off there with there was something I wanted to think about. There was a time in the process of the SRF lawsuit. You know, Swamiji was very courageous. Beyond courageous. He was extraordinary through the whole 12-year cycle and all the personal attacks and everything, but he went through a lot of different things too. It wasn't as if this is part of the... Oh, I know, I was talking... I haven't finished this thought yet, have I? I've just sort of... It's like teenagers talk. And then you know, and it was so like, wow, I mean, you were there. And there's a lot of communication that happens. So when people talk about the difference between the spoken and the written word, you could say that, and you would like, no, that, I mean, you understand, and so. But that wouldn't transcribe very well. But back when I was talking about cutting people up and making them cardboard, and so you can't grasp anymore. It also, I don't feel like I ever quite finished that thought. Let me just go back. At least there was a little more to it, which is, you know, we really understand how a person, we need to understand how you become a saint. We need to understand how you become self-realized. And the only way we can understand that is if we have real pictures of how great souls do live their lives. And if we really know what happens to them. Even it's very important to understand how an avatar lives, because they don't come just to dance on the waves of life and pretend. They come to really live through a human experience and demonstrate the right attitude and the right response to it. And so there's a veil of delusion over their eyes to some extent, or they're like actors who get lost in the part and really speak the lines with the passion that the lines need to be spoken. They're not unreal. And when we, in the attempt to make them more and more special, we make them less and less like us, we diminish their capacity to help us. I think in one of these classes I was talking about how when we were in Italy before going over to India just this last cycle, and there was discussion happening about the publication of Conversations with Yogananda. And Bill and Carol Swanner, who've been publishing books for YSS in India for YSS for the last 7 years, raised the question, no, Durga raised the question, that when we published a book, Devi Mukherjee's book, and we just said Yogananda, Devi Mukherjee said that's very offensive. It has to be Paramahansa Yogananda, and even more than that, it has to be Sri Sri Paramahansa Yogananda. Sri Sri Paramahansa Yogananda 108 is how they put it. As if you said Sri 108 times, because that's how you show your reference. And Swami's book is called Conversations with Yogananda. And they raised the question that this could be just considered, you know, just so insulting that you won't be taken seriously as a devotee. Swami thought about it for a while, and he said, no. He said, we're going to do it our way. He said, because all of that makes it seem so abnormal, was the word he used. When you can't just speak of Yogananda, you have to speak of Sri Maharaj, Paramhansa Yogananda 108. Every time you speak of him, he gets more and more unreal, and that doesn't necessarily increase your devotion. It just increases your sense of separation. You know, real devotion makes you intimate. When you really love someone, you're not afraid of them. You can be very natural. It's not, they don't need this praise. It's we who need to feel that this is my father, this is my mother. And all of those distance things don't help. I remember as a child, I really didn't like to call people Mr. So-and-so or Mrs. So-and-so, because it always made me feel separated from them, and I just wanted to be. And I could feel that if I could have just called them like everybody else called them, by their first names. Barbara Rabin, who's in our school here, of course, in our school, we call teachers by their first names, but she started that practice as a first grade teacher in schools where it was not done at all. Because she saw that if the children could feel relaxed and comfortable and really at ease, they would learn better. And they learned better just calling her Barbara. It was the easiest way. And she had to fight a lot to get that across, but she just knew it was true. And it just worked for them. And so, if this is the nearest of the dear to you, but you can't even say his name without putting all these formal titles on it, it doesn't help the situation. And so, in the same way, out of respect, we keep adding layers, and we don't talk about difficulties, and we don't ever want to talk about moments when they wavered, or, you know, tests that they really had to meet, or ugly things that might have happened, or lawsuits that were filed against them, or, you know, any of those things. But then when those things happen to us, we don't have any models. And we also, it makes us feel like this somehow is not part of spiritual life. So Swamiji, in the course of going through all that he had to go through, his greatness And the way he dealt with it was not that he never struggled to deal with it. It was that he always struggled to deal with it, which was to say that he always put forth the energy to deal with it, and he was always very extremely real in it. Well, one interesting moment that went through all of this was Swamiji went through several days where he just suddenly had this great concern that maybe Master's teachings were false. Because how could Tara and Daya have followed them so devotedly for so long and be such unsaintly at the end of it? You know, so unkind, so unfeeling, so confused. And you can, it's easy to just sort of say, oh, well, that doesn't, you know, you have all these glib explanations, but if a person is caught in a thought, Swamiji's never been one to paste over his concerns with a glib explanation. You know, he's always had the courage. Years ago, when I was first knowing him, getting to know him, I came from a very intellectual family, and there was a tremendous premium put on intellectuality, you know, not just intelligence, but being intellectual. And of course, I grew up very disbalanced. I mean, I was disbalanced, so I was born into that family. I mean, and then they helped make it worse. And so what I just loved about Swamiji, was enormously attracted to, among other things, was he was so smart, just educated and smart, and he just had such interesting things to say about everything. And I became very interested in, how could he be so smart? I mean, so many times, people, I and others, would bring to him just some problem we just could not figure out, and he would just see the solution. Just over and over and over again. I mean, I learned he had superconscious help. But he also could just think clearly. He could look at a situation and he could just see it without prejudice. And that was not the word I used at first, but he could just think clearly. I mean, where my mind would get all fogged and I could only think of so many alternatives because I had all these, what I gradually realized was emotional biases that literally just cut off channels of thought. And I began to realize that the clarity of his mind came from the courage of his heart, that he just wasn't afraid. Now, so many of us are afraid. I remember, and it's very often, you know, when we criticize others, the reason we criticize others that as long as they're wrong, we don't have to change. And we don't know we're doing that. That's not like we know that we're doing that. We just look at them and we see why there are all these difficulties. Sometimes we're very reasonable about it and everything. But you get way down into it and it's like, if they're not wrong, then that means that I have to do something. I remember this woman in the community. Swamiji was writing the book about education as it happened. And he was passing the manuscript out to various people, and this one woman would call me every night with these picayune things about his manuscript. Well, here he says, you know, this word is like that, and that's not really the right word, and the better word would be this. And I would just be like, you know, yes. And went on it for about 4 nights, and I finally just said, one night I couldn't stand it. I don't have Swami's patience. I said, what are you talking about? Like that. And somehow just my exasperation was God-given at that moment. Because she said, just burst out. She said, if he's not wrong, I'm going to have to do what he says. Just like that. I said, oh, that's no problem. You're talking about fear. Let's talk about fear now. Let's not talk about this manuscript anymore, okay? You know, and it was just like she had to just keep nitpicking. Because as long as there was something wrong with him, she didn't have to face the real issue, which is that he was asking of her a level of courage and self-honesty and self-transformation that she was very afraid to put forward, which is quite understandable. You know, it's quite understandable to have those fears. We all have those fears. So let me think where I was going. Oh, so it's very important that we understand that even great souls go with this. So when Swamiji had the thought, you know, the thought came to him, well, maybe Master's teachings aren't right. He didn't just cover that thought up. You know, like, I'm a disciple of Master, I've been a disciple all these years, how can I possibly think that? He didn't condemn himself. He didn't run away from the question. He probably knew that there was an answer to it. You know, it wasn't like he was that filled with doubt. But it was a question that had to really be examined. And in fact, actually, I think somebody else first brought it up to him, because it was they were really wondering, how could this be true? And so Master Swamiji for several days was very quiet, very thoughtful, and just reflected on it. Finally came back and he said, I don't know why it had that effect on them, he said, but I know the effect it had on me, he said. So I know it's true because I know it from my own experience. Isn't that interesting? Now, of course, he's worked it out farther, because when he wrote this book, he had other ways of putting it. But Master just helped them go forward as far as they could go forward. That's all. That's all it's here to do. That's the amazing thing about... That's what I was starting to say. Maybe I'll talk about this now, too. The example I was going to use, I was talking about how Swamiji can support everyone. Whoever you are, Master will just help you go forward. And one person's forward may be exactly the opposite of another person's forward. You just have to move. You know, Daya and Tara had to play this thing out. They had to take that thought form that they had, and they have had to push it as far as they had to push it. They couldn't learn the lesson until they pushed it to the end. I've often thought that, you know, Swamiji himself has not put it exactly like this, but Daya is a deeply loyal, devoted disciple. And Swamiji says, he says it so sweetly, I know God sees more recent events in the context of the whole picture. You know, and Swamiji, I was the only possible person who could take over SRF. And Swami will say things like, Master had to use what he had. You know, Master had put his hope actually in Daya's brother, Richard Wright. You read an autobiography of a yogi, Richard Wright was the one who was going to follow him. But Richard didn't come through. And, you know, Rajasi died, and Daya was the only one there was. This is what God gave you. And it was her karma to have this opportunity, to have this role and this money and this power and this thing, to just play this thing out to the end. And she's still playing it out to the end. She's still there playing it out to the end. She's as absolutely fixed and unchanging as she has ever been. Remarkable to us, not remarkable to her. And then she'll be in the astral world and she'll figure it out. But you see, it's important to know that, because God knows. Think about what might happen to us. Think what weird little strange stories we're going to play out in our lives. And we need to know, well, Daya did it too. Tara was peculiar. Swami doubted. And we all get through it. But if we never know that it ever happened to anybody else, we get so ashamed, we don't know what to do with it, we think we're not good devotees anymore, we cover it up, we hide it from ourselves. And it's just a mess. Just a terrible mess. I mean, this is a mess too, but it's a different kind of mess. You know? Are you raising your hand, Marilyn? No?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I just lost my train of thought, so it's a good thing. Uh-huh. Well, that's why we're not there. So, I mean, what you say is self-evident, isn't it, to us? But other people look for that kind of security, and they don't think about the flaws of it. They're just looking for something else. People have their own reasons. When I was, you know, a kid at Ananda, and Swamiji just once said to me, he said, I said something about how grateful I was for all that he was doing. He said, oh, yes. He said, you would never have made it at SRF, meaning in the monastery. And then he looked at me and said, you wouldn't even have been able to be a church member. And he's absolutely right. The first time somebody just told me to do something and I asked why and they told me not to ask questions, I mean, that just would have been it. Because it just, whatever karma each of us have, you know, we all have our own karma in this. And we're just not that type. And yeah, Daya's made a terrible mistake. She's gotten herself in a position. They have a shoot the messenger policy in SRF, which is if you bring bad news, instead of accepting the bad news, they shoot the messenger. If you're the bearer of bad news, that means by definition you must be out of tune, because you wouldn't be perceiving anything that would be perceived as bad news unless you're out of tune, so they just get rid of you. Yeah, it's just nuts. It's very, very common. I mean, I'm sure many of you have worked in corporations that work like that. And then ultimately they die. Everything has its period of flowering and its period of dying. Now, having said all that, you see, that's why this book is so important. Because the karmic inclinations to pull things into these karmic Kali Yuga delusions is institutional. It's institutional with master's work, and it's individual. I mean, just exactly the same. People bring you bad news and you want to shoot the messenger. People's working with people is very messy, and they create all this confusion, and you want to control them. You want to organize something that will keep them in line. We forget. It's not wrong. Swamiji also holds a very, attunement is very important. And as I said, we're freer, but we're not absolutely free. I recall having a dispute once with a now ex meditation group leader in the Northwest, because I was in charge at that time of that whole area, and this man was running the group, and he was teaching energization in a way that wasn't right. And several different times I said, he was teaching it too fast. He was just having people do energization so fast they couldn't do it. And I kept saying to him, this just is not the way to teach it. And he just would sort of look at me like, who are you to speak? And finally, I had nothing else to say. I had to say, I said the highway that we call Ananda is very, very wide. I said, but it has edges. And when I say that that's not the way Swamiji wants us to teach energization, that's an edge. Okay? You cannot then say to me, no, I think I'll do it differently. I said, I don't know what the edges are, but this is one of them. You may teach it to anyone you want like that, but you can't do it in the name of Ananda. And so this is sort of a fine line, and it is even in our own lives with each other. At what point do you have to say, that's my edge? How broad can your highway be? When are you really threatened? When is the truth really threatened, and when do you just imagine that it's threatened? We're always thinking that things threaten us. I had fun recently. Everybody has their sensitivities. There was this man, this great big man with a huge loud voice, and he was just one of those people whose sense of, he was from Europe, and his sense of personal space was extremely different than mine. And just his physical size and the noise with which he spoke, combined with his sense of that about 3 inches is all the personal space I needed, and the fact that when he, gave me my 3 inches, he leaned over me like this, just rang every bell that I have. But I just had to say to myself, am I really being hurt? Because everything in me thought I was being hurt. But it became a marvelous exercise. Am I really being hurt? What is being hurt? It's not really injuring my eardrums. And then I just sort of just, why should I make this an edge? Some things you are being hurt. Or if the man was leaning over me and saying rude and insulting things about Swami, that's an edge. I wouldn't have put up with that. But he wasn't. He was just telling his life story just from 3 inches away at the top of his voice. But it's a good exercise, because otherwise you get I don't mean to go from there immediately to SRF, but you do. You begin to think that all of these things have to be controlled. Do they really? And Swamiji, elsewhere, I don't think it's in this book at all. I'll just tell you this and then we'll call it quits. I don't know what book he was writing. Can't remember now, they all blend together. But Swamiji had always, it was sort of a common understanding at SRF that Master wasn't really an organizer, quote. Because, even Swamiji writes here about it's time to get organized. Master said you have to get organized. And so Swamiji had just sort of for many years just kind of accepted the thought that Master really wasn't much of an organizer. And he was writing some book. Maybe it was a book about leadership. And again, this is his incredible honesty. He came back and he said, I've always been saying this. He said, but it wasn't true at all. He said, Master had SRF. exactly organized. It was entirely organized by magnetism. It's that he put out so much magnetism that he didn't have to set any other boundaries, because that magnetism held everything in order. He said, but it wasn't casual. It was very conscious. It was a way of organizing. And in fact, Swamiji had to say, that's how he organizes. And I know when Sarah Crier did the book of interviews of people, Reflections on Community Living or whatever it's called, and several people in there, not several, maybe one or two or three, I'm not sure how many, different people, in telling a story, and you sort of tell a story to get a laugh a little bit, and as a speaker you get prone to things like that, and two or three of them told stories where, and then Swamiji just, you know, gave me the project and just left us to work it out, like that. Swamiji answered, he said, I did not. He said, I led through consciousness. He said, and that's the kind of leaders you should be. He said, I never left you on your own, he said. My consciousness was always there with you. And he was very stern about it, and he made them go back and fix the book, because it was misleading, because he didn't leave them on their own. He might not have talked to them or stayed there with them, but he never left them on their own. And he also wanted us to understand, those of us who were in positions of responsibility, you must lead with your consciousness. He didn't just mean by example. He meant with your magnetism. And he meant a conscious exercise of magnetism. Not merely I'm dynamic and then therefore other people follow in my wake. No, a conscious extension of your consciousness into the situation, and to keep it there. And of course, that's what Master did. And an omnipresent guru can do it at a higher level, but we can all do it to a very large extent. It's very, very interesting. But that's how you keep things in order. And then you don't need any rules. Why would you have to have rules after that? That's the secret of Ananda. That's the secret of Master. That's the secret of the spiritual path. That's the secret of Dwapara and higher ages. And when you lose that magnetism, I often say to people, you know, by the time we have to make a rule about it, it's already ruined anyway, so why bother? If we have to make a rule about that, we might as well just shut the door. If people don't see it, what we need to do is we need to bring people back to the point where they see it. Because just making a rule, who wants it? Who wants to live in a place where you have to make rules about things that people should perceive from the inside? That just kills it. And that's what we're working with. Okay. I think that's the story for tonight. All right, see you next week. Whatever, we read about another 50 or 60 pages, I think. It's an interesting book, isn't it? No, it's easier to read than some, I'll say that.